All right. Hello, everybody. Good to see everybody. And we are in our last lesson on the book of Daniel. Not the last lesson of the Visions of God series, because we got a lot more visions to go in the Bible, but we are in the last book of Daniel chapter 12. And this is kind of a summation. This is a continuation of the vision of chapter 11. And so to kind of put it all in context here, I've drawn our great metal image from the very first vision of Nebuchadnezzar that Daniel interpreted. And I put on it some of our symbols and things. And let's see. Something I can write. It's going to be a different color. So originally said, you know, there was a head of gold, the chest and arms of silver, the belly and thighs of bronze, the legs of feet and the toes of of iron, and the feet of iron mixed with clay. And then it says a stone cut out without hands would strike it and break it all to pieces, and that stone would grow into a great mountain that would fill the whole earth. And the interpretation of the dream that was given to Daniel was Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar, and his empire was the head of gold, that the Medo-Persians were going to be the second empire, the Greeks would be the third, and the Romans would be the fourth. And the kingdom, and these were all empires, and the empire, the kingdom that would be established after the stone breaks the statue, would never be given over to another people. So here you have an empire. Empire rises, given over to another people. Empire rises and falls, given to another people. Rises and falls, given to another people. Rises and falls, given to a kingdom that has no end. Okay? So we have the second vision that Daniel had, which had the lion that was given a man's heart, the bear, the leopard with the four wings and the four wings and the four heads. And then the great beast, which I figuratively call a T-Rex, is basically had great teeth and great claws, and it stomped everything to death. Then we had a vision later of the ram and the he-goat. And this was talking about the transition point right here, the transition between the Medo-Persian era and the Greek era. It makes it very clear. It says the ram had two horns. There was lopsided, one was greater than the other, that's the Medo-Persians. And then he says, the other one is a kigo with a notable single horn. And it has great power, it moves really fast, it breaks the horns of the ram, it takes over, stomps it to bits, and then, at the height of its power, that horn is broken off and replaced by four horns, pointing to the four winds of heaven. And it says very plainly, it says, this is Greece. This is Greece that's going to come. So here you're talking about Alexander the Great coming, and this transition, this whole thing of the ram and the he-goat is talking about that period of time. Then we have the extensive long vision of chapter 11, which we're still at the end of that vision, which got into all that great detail. Well, we have the 70 weeks. We have the 70 weeks as well. And the 70 weeks was established from a period of time. The 770s that we talked about, it said from the time to go home, in fact, it was the Medo-Persian part, wasn't it, Greek part? From the time to go home, from the decree to send the people home to Messiah, is going to be 69 weeks, and there's going to be another week after that. And we talked about the weeks or sevens, that it wasn't necessarily a literal period of time, that it was talking about a symbolic period of time. Then we had the vision that we just finished, the first big chunk of, which he goes into this incredible detail about all the historical events that are going to happen. Kings of the north, kings of the south, rising and falling, fighting each other, marrying each other, betraying each other, all the different things. Running up and down through Palestine, stomping on Jerusalem, defiling the temple, you know, all that stuff. That is all discussing this period of time, the Greek Empire. So we had that whole section was in chapter 11, and that was the Greek Empire. And so it was getting all those details. Remember, as we got to the end of chapter 11, We said that all of a sudden, the king of, you know, there's all this discussion, the king of the north, the king of the south are going to do this to each other. And there were generations of those kings. And that was the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemy Empire, which were both Greek. They were originally from Alexander's four generals. Two of them, one was named Seleucus and the other one was named Ptolemy. And so this was the whole era of the Greek Empire. And during that time, the Roman Empire started to come up. And at the end of the chapter we were just in, chapter 11, you have now the king of the north is representing Rome, and Rome is taken over. And we know historically that happened. Eventually the Greek dynasties, the Seleucid and Ptolemy dynasties, were taken over by Rome. And by the time you get to the first century, when Messiah comes, when Christ comes, it's all ruled by Rome. So that's where we were getting to this point. Now the 70 weeks says you're going to have Messiah is going to come, and then he's going to be cut off. So there's the cross. But not for himself. You know, not for his own sins. It's going to be cut off for someone else. And of course, that's Christ on the cross for us. And then it says, at the end of the 70 weeks, you're going to have your people, and he says, you know, I want to know what's going to happen to my people in my holy city. And he says, they're going to be completely destroyed. So we have this, we know where the end of this time period is. The end of the 77s is 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed. Now, all that context leads us to where we are now in chapter 12. Daniel is in the middle of this vision of the man, the angelic being clothed in linen. It says, describes him as a man clothed in linen. You know, typical angelic being in that they are awesome. They don't always look the same, but they are always awesome. And that's what's happening. So, the first verse of chapter 12 says, at that time, Michael shall stand up. So this is like a therefore, right? You got to go back and say, what's it there for? So I'm going to start back in chapter 11, and I'm just going to read the last little bit, and read right on into 12 so we keep the context of the vision. So let's see. Verse 40, chapter 11. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he shall enter into the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. I'm going to stop there for a second. The Romans never overtook those areas, by the way. He shall have power. We're talking about the Romans here, about the king of the north. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. At that time, chapter 12, verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, every one who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this river bank and one on that river bank. And one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly. And none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But you go your way till the end, for you shall rest and will arise to your inheritance at the end of the days. And that's the end of the book of Daniel. Now, is this not packed with stuff? There's all kinds of stuff in here. So let's just go through it. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. Now, we've heard about Michael before. When did we hear about Michael? You remember right at the beginning of this? Daniel was praying, fasting for three weeks. And the angel that came to him said, as soon as you started praying, I was sent to you, but I got held up in Persia, fighting with the prince of Persia. And then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. And let me come, and that's why I'm come here to you. So we know a couple things about this Michael. Michael is one of the angelic beings, as is the man that's talking to Daniel right now. There are angelic beings that serve God and serve His purpose, and there are angelic beings that serve the devil and his purposes. Even though God is still in control, and they ultimately serve Him, because they can't, they can disobey Him, but there's only a certain limit by which they can go. So you have this angelic being, heavenly being, demonic being, we're not exactly sure, who is referenced here as the Prince of Persia, who is dealing with, now remember, the Medo-Persian kingdom is where Daniel is. Daniel's right here. Daniel's right in the middle here when he's having his vision. So he says there is a confrontation between angelic beings over the kingdom of Persia, the empire of Persia. There are ones that are trying to do God's will, and there are ones that are going against God's will for that thing. And, you know, we talk about this all the time in Daniel. What's the key to the book? What's the whole book about? God is in control, period. And Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, God raises up kings and he takes down kings. How does he go about doing that? Raising up kings and taking down kings. Well, we're getting an example here. These angelic beings who do his will support or tear down kingdoms. We've seen this happen. Right, we saw it happen in Isaiah. Remember what happened when the Rabshakeh, the general of the king of Assyria, came down with 185,000 Assyrians and surrounded Jerusalem and was going to take out Jerusalem, and Hezekiah, the king of Israel, got all upset. You know, he was crying out, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" And Isaiah says, "Will you just wait?" What happened that night?
One angel came and destroyed everyone.
185,000 Assyrian soldiers died in one night from one angel. That's what Scripture tells us. So here you have a situation where there is an angel trying to mess around, or some sort of being, trying to mess around with Persia and withhold God's messenger coming to Daniel, keep him from doing God's will. And then Michael comes along and takes over the fight there, and frees up this guy to go talk to Daniel. So now when he gets here to talking about Michael, he's talking about the same Michael. And Michael, it's important to remember, his name means, who is like God. Now whether there are no question marks in the language, so we don't know if that means who is like God, like this person is like God. Some people use that and say, well, maybe that's like Jesus. But then the most common interpretation of it is a question or a challenge. Who is like God? But that's his existence, is to challenge anyone who would stand up against God and say, who is like God? You know, what do you got? I got God on my side. What do you got? You know, it's that kind of a thought.
In the New Testament, he's called Michael the Archangel.
The Archangel.
He's the guy in charge.
He's one of the chief, and here in Daniel, he says he's one of the chief princes. You know, so we know there's ranks of angelic beings. Some have more authority than others. But there's another thing we know. Jesus was not an angel. The book of Hebrews tells us that. And it says, Jesus said after his resurrection, what? All power and authority on heaven and on earth has been given to me. So whatever power and authority these guys had, it came to an end with Christ taking his throne. Okay. Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. Now, who's his people? Talking to Daniel, who's his people?
The Jews.
The sons of your people. He's talking about the nation of Israel. And this is Michael who stands watch over your nation. Now that fits the other things we had, right? There's a prince trying to an evil angel trying to do something in the kingdom of Persia. He's watching over the kingdom of Persia trying to cause mischief. He holds up the man who's coming to talk to Daniel. Michael comes and fights against him to make sure that whatever God says is going to happen in the kingdom of Persia happens. Okay? Then here it says, we're down here at the end now. We've got the Romans are in control. And down at this period, he says, then Michael, who stands up for your people, who watches over your people, will stand up. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never has never since there was a nation, even to that time. Now, we hear this a couple of times. We heard this in Isaiah. There's going to be a time of trouble such as never been and will never be. What trouble is he talking about in Isaiah? He tells us the destruction of Jerusalem that happened in 586 BC. Right? Here, he's not talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's already destroyed. So he's talking about another time of great trouble. What about Jesus? Remember what Jesus said when we're not going to go into a detailed study of this until we get later. In Revelation we will. But in Matthew 24, Jesus sits there and says, you know, the disciples are with him. They're all in Jerusalem and they're looking at all the great buildings of Herod's temple. And they go, wow, Jesus, look at these great buildings. And you know what Jesus says? He says, you see all these buildings? There's coming a time where there'll not be one stone left on another. And then they say, wow, Jesus, when is that going to happen? And what about your coming and the end of the age, the end of time, or the end? Right? They're asking these three questions, and Jesus gives them three answers. And he says, first of all, as far as this whole building thing getting knocked down, he says, when you see Jerusalem encompassed with armies, you know the time has come. Okay? That happened in 70 AD. It happened in 68 AD when the armies came. All the Christians, by the way, got up and left town when they saw it coming because they knew what this prophecy meant. The Jews stayed there. 2 years later, Jerusalem was destroyed. They were all killed. You can read about it in Josephus. Then he says, what's going to be the sign of your coming? And he says, look, there are going to be lots of people saying, lo, he's here, lo, he's there. Don't be deceived. He said, when the Son of Man comes, it's going to be like the lightning. And everyone's going to know. Not going to be a secret. That blows away about two or three major cults that say that Jesus has already come, but it was secret. You know, like the Jehovah's Witnesses teach that. It's obviously false. And then he says, when he talks about these things, the end, he says, now when you see the abomination that causes desolation set up, as spoken of by the prophet Daniel, this is Jesus quoting Daniel, and then he says, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Jerusalem flee to the mountains. Now he's talking about this thing. Now, we're going to hear this. Now we've already heard of an abomination. We've already heard of the temple being desecrated once in Ezekiel, didn't we? Well, actually in Daniel. First of all, it was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. It gets rebuilt after they go back, right? Read Ezra and Nehemiah. The temple gets rebuilt. Then, in the middle of this Greek period, Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, comes up, and he doesn't destroy the temple, he desecrates it. He goes in, and he sacrifices pigs on the altar, and he spreads pig broth all over the whole place, and he sets up an idol in there, but this is a different time. Jesus is quoting, Jesus is saying, when you see this happen, get ready. That turns out something very similar happens when Titus comes in and destroys the temple. But, this is all in context. So, and at that time, verse 1b, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. What book? What do we know about this book? Just from the context of this verse, without looking at the rest of the Bible. What do we know about this book? There are names written in the book. Names of people.
It's the book of life.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. It's pretty clear if you read the rest of the references of this in the context of the Bible. But even if you just look at this, your people will be delivered, everyone who's found written in the book. We know that names are written in the book. It's about people, and it's about those who are delivered are written in the book. Every other place we read about the book of life, right? We read about the great white throne judgment scene, the end of Revelation, it says The dead, small and great, are all up standing before the throne of God, and books are opened. And another book is opened, which is the book of life. Remember, I had a lesson on this about a year ago. There's the books of remembrance, where it says that everything you do is written down. Right? And then there's the book of life, which are those who are God's and who are Christ's. And so here he's talking about the book of life because he says they're going to be delivered. Verse 2, and many of those who sleep in the dust shall awake, some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Okay, what do we got here? You got people sleeping in the dust and they arise some to everlasting, what does it say? Some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. What do we got here? What's it talking about? It's talking about a resurrection, right? They're sleeping in the dust and now they're not in the dust anymore. Okay. How many times does the Bible talk about resurrections? Let's name a few. We got one. We know one big one, right? One big one at the end, right? So it says all, everybody, small and great, the wicked, the good, everybody. That's generally called the general resurrection. You got the resurrection of Jesus on the third day. You've got the resurrection of Lazarus, who Jesus called from the grave. That was a resurrection. You've got a symbolic resurrection in the book of Ezekiel. Remember the Valley of Dry Bones? And he said, they're all saying, I'm like my bones are dry, and I'm gone. You know, we're done. And God says, Ezekiel, go out and look at this valley of dry bones. He says, can these bones live? And he says, yes, Lord, you know. And flesh comes over them, and they're still not alive yet. And then God breathes the breath of life into them, and they come alive. And he said, this is what's going to happen to the nation of Israel. They will come back. Right now, they're scattered like this valley of dry bones. But they will come back, yeah.
How did Jesus raise a little dead girl?
There are some people who are raised from the dead, yes. You have Tabitha. You have Eutychus, you know, Paul raises Eutychus. You have Dorcas, who is raised from the dead. They're not in the grave necessarily, but, you know, they're, I mean, I was separating that just those that are in the graves. It says many who are in the graves or sleep in the dust. But you could say also, you know, there are resurrections. So, first of all, there are multiple resurrections mentioned in the Bible. That's the point.
And yeah, the saints are resurrected with Christ.
Very interesting point. Yes. It says when let's see, how's it go? Jesus is on the cross. He cries out, it is finished. And the temple, the veil of the temple is rent, torn from the top to the bottom, which means it had to be by God. And it says, and what? Many righteous persons were raised from the graves. The graves were opened. Remember the great earthquake? The graves were opened, and many righteous people were rose and were seen by many in Jerusalem. So, this could also very, very easily be referring to that. But there's another interesting part. It says, many of those who sleep. Notice it doesn't say all. It says many. If it was talking about the general resurrection, it'd say all. Right? Because it's real clear in Revelation, it's all. It says everybody, small and great, good and bad, everybody. Here it says many. Some to everlasting life. So we could say those that rose when Christ died could be accounted for there. But then it says, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So there's a judgment going on there. Or at least a reference to judgment.
When Jesus talked about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 24, mm-hmm. He talks about he talked about that there will be those that would betray the righteous.
Yeah.
Not everyone stayed faithful.
Right.
Under the circumstances.
So
those would have been, in a sense, raised to shame, I guess.
There's several different interpretations of this, and I think the one that I find myself leaning toward here, there is a general symbolic interpretation of this that says, okay, Michael comes. Remember, we're in this time period. So what does the 77s tell us? Messiah is here. Messiah is cut off. Right? And then we know the kingdom. His kingdom comes because it's the stone that strikes the foot of the idol. So you've got all these things that say, you know, just in general, what's going to happen. God's taking control. Jesus, you know, he's already in control. But Jesus is going to come. His kingdom is going to happen. And then the righteous are going to be blessed and the wicked are going to be condemned. You could say that generally anyway. But whether or not we're talking about specifically what happened in Jerusalem when Jesus died. By the way, why did that happen? Man, I wish I had another hour this morning. There's so much good stuff in this chapter. Why did those people, why were the graves opened when Jesus died? Remember, it happened the same day. The scripture tells us. What happened when Jesus died? What happened between the time that he died and the time that he rose? Scripture tells us. It says that he led captivity captive. You know, he says, all power has been given to me. He says, I have the keys of death and of Hades. Remember when he says that? What does that mean? He's got the keys, he can open the doors. When he opens the doors, guess who gets to come out?
He controls your future.
He controls it. So you have all that situation going on. Verse 3. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And this is talking about the righteous, obviously, in this time period. Those who are wise and those who turn many to righteousness. You're going to hear this reference to those who are wise here toward the end of the book. Verse 4. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. Wow. But you, Daniel, shut up the words. Now, you know what's unique about this? This is the only time a prophet of God is told to shut up the words. Well, he's told in another place, seal it up because it's for a long time off. He says, shut them up. Now, there's another place where a prophet is told whether or not he should shut up words. His name's John in the book of Revelation. You know when he's told twice? Do not shut up these words because the time is at hand. Do not shut them up. The time is at hand. Daniel is sitting here in the middle of the Medo-Persian Empire. He's been given all kinds of detailed prophecy about what's going to happen over the next several hundred years until the coming of Christ and the destruction of Jerusalem. And he's told to seal them up. Remember, there's another prophecy that says, I heard this prophecy and I understood it, but the time was long. He's here, he's saying the time was long to get to there. He's told, shut up all this detail until we get to here. And yet we read the book of Revelation and it says, do not seal it up for the time is at hand. And we go, oh my, this has got to all talk about thousands of years in the future from when it was written. See how that doesn't make sense? If you listen to the book, and Jesus is the one, by the way, in Revelation saying that. If you listen to Jesus, he says, the time is at hand. So whatever's written in the book of Revelation was relevant to the people of that day. When John wrote it and they sent it out. Relevant. It was important for them to know. It was not talking about, oh, none of this is going to matter for thousands of years. Doesn't really matter for you because it's all talking about future nations and future tribulations and everything, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 years from now. No, he says the time is at hand. Okay. Notice he says many will run to and fro and knowledge shall increase. People are going to be looking. And like I said, when we started Daniel, Daniel's one of those books that people, man, people had 1,000 different interpretations of Daniel. And knowledge shall increase. Why will knowledge increase relevant to this prophecy, to these prophecies? Because time is happening. When you get down, then all of a sudden, remember, he's up here. The Greeks haven't even come on the scene yet. And then when the Greeks start happening, somebody's reading Daniel, you know, they're sitting there going, man, they'll be reading Daniel and say, man, I don't know what this, I don't even understand this. And then all of a sudden all these Greek kings start coming and going. They go, you know something? This sounds a lot like what we heard in Daniel. By the time you get to the Roman era, somebody reading Daniel, they can go, yep, looky there. There's Antiochus Epiphanes. You see what it is? So as knowledge increased, as time passed on, people would learn more and more about this. The wise would. Keep that in mind. Then I, Daniel, looked, verse 5, and there stood two others, one on this riverbank and one on that riverbank. And one said to the man clothed in linen who's over the waters, this is the angelic being he saw first, When he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? Now there's a very interesting, very precise question. How long is it going to be till all this stuff you've been telling me is going to be done? Now remember the context. He isn't just talking about Michael standing up. He's talking about this whole period. Remember, this is all one vision. He's talking about all this detailed history of what's going to happen in the Greeks and the Romans and the Messiah. And he's saying, how long is it going to be till all this stuff is done? Very specific question. Look at the answer. Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. Now, if this wasn't symbolical reference, you might feel a little disappointed right now because, you know, you say, here we have a really specific question. When is all this stuff going to happen? Right? And what does the angel say? Oh, it's going to happen in AD 65 in March. Or AD 68 or AD 70. He doesn't say that. What does he say? Time, times, and half a time. Now, we've talked about that a lot because it's shown up a lot. It's going to show up more in the book of Revelation.
Sound like he's talking in riddles.
Well, in a degree he is. What is that? What is it? The verse you always like? The secret things belong to God?
Deuteronomy 29:29.
Deuteronomy 29:29.
Jim says that's the default version.
Yeah. And there's another one. Solomon said it is the glory of God to conceal a matter and the glory of kings to seek it out. Are there times when God does talk to us in parables and in riddles? Yes. Obviously Jesus did. He talked in parables too, right? But here we go again. What's this three and a half thing again? What's this time, times, and half a time thing again? Do you remember when we talked about it the first time? The first time, times, time, and half a time show up in the Bible is Elijah. Elijah is under persecution by Ahab and Jezebel, and God takes care of him, and he prays and it stops rain for 3.5 years. And that 3.5, that times, times, and half a time, every time it's mentioned in Scripture, at least, it might have other interpretations, but at least it talks about a time period where the people of God are going to be persecuted, but protected. And that time, because it's half a seven, it's a broken seven, and we talk all those things about seven sevens, it's God's completed work, it's God's perfection, completeness, fully done, completely done, nothing more need to be done. If you're half a seven, what does that say? It's not complete. It's not at the level of what God would do. So when you hear about persecution lasting for half a seven, a broken seven, you're hearing saying, yes, there's going to be a time of persecution, and some of you are going to die, and some of you will make it through. But I'm going to protect you anyway, even if you die. Right? This is what, you know, this is what God told us. This is what Jesus told us all the way through. Okay. Times, times, and half a time. But notice the last of it. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. Now, where did we hear about that before? I believe it's in chapter 9. When we talk about the 77s, let's go back there for a second. Verse 24, chapter 9. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. 70 weeks. And that are 77s. So here you have, this is another reference to this happening here. He says, and when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered. Now, who's the holy people? He's talking to Daniel. Who's the holy people? The Jews, the Jewish nation, right? When did the Jewish nation cease to exist?
70.
AD 70, when the Romans came in and destroyed it, completely destroyed it, destroyed Jerusalem, flattened it. The nation of Israel ceased to exist. And Daniel was told, this is about your people and the end of your nation and the end of your holy city. And here he says, the power of the holy people are completely shattered. It's all talking about the same thing. So you have a situation where it's saying down here at 70 AD, you know, down here in the Iron Age, down here in the legs of the Romans, the nation of Israel, the national people of God, comes to an end completely. There is no more king, there is no more temple, there is no more priesthood, there is no more national boundary of Israel. Godly national boundary. Doesn't matter if somebody, you know, I can go out here and draw, you know, I could have convince everybody in Rutherford County to secede from the Union of the United States of America, and I could call this place Israel. That doesn't mean it's God's land. And that's exactly the same as what's going over there in Palestine. It's because a bunch of people who are descended from Jews come over there, and with the help of the United Nations and the British government after World War II, establish a nation and call it Israel, does not mean that it's God's people. Or that it's God's nation, just because you call it something doesn't make it so. So here you have the end of the Jewish nation as God's people. The end. Now that's the physical end of it. It was a physical nation, wasn't it? It was a physical nation. With a physical temple, physical priesthood, physical king. It had already been replaced in God's eyes by a spiritual kingdom. The church. A spiritual king. Christ. Spiritual Israel, like Paul talks about. Which is who? The saved. Christians. So here you have the end of God's dealing with man as a nation, as his special genetic people descended from Abraham, circumcised on the eighth day, all that kind of stuff, all that physical stuff ends. And it's saying it's going to be done. Now, verse 8. Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, Lord, what should be the end of these things? Now what he's saying here is, what's going to happen? You know, he says, you've been telling me all this stuff. You know, Daniel was sitting there. Remember he said, I read my books from Jeremiah that the 70 years of captivity should be up now. And he was praying, God, please restore Israel. Bring us back. Let us rebuild the city. Let us rebuild the temple. The angel comes and says, yep, that's what's going to happen. But let me tell you about 77s. You've already been in for 7 years, 70 years. You've already been in captivity. I'm going to tell you about seven times that with the 77s prophecy. And here he gets to this part and he says, so what's going to happen? What's going to happen after that? What's the result of all of this? You're telling me that my people are going to be shattered and all that's going to be over. What's the result? Where's it all going? Notice what he says, verse 9. And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end. Now he was told to shut up the words and seal the book, right? Just a few verses before. But now he's told by the angel. The angel, by the way, has been pretty good about answering his questions in all these visions. You know, he says, what is this? We're going to see the same thing in John. In Revelation, right? John several talks to one of the elders, he talks to one of the angels, says, what is this? You know, and they tell him. But here he asks a question and the angel says, nope, sorry. Sealed up. This isn't for you to know, Daniel. Go your way. They're sealed up to the time of the end. What end? We hear that and we go, end. It must be the end of time, the great white throne judgment scene, the end of everybody. Who's he talking to? Daniel. What's he just been telling him about? The end of his people, which occurred in 70 AD. It's sealed up to the end.
And the end of the tabernacle.
The end of the temple, the end of the tabernacle, the end of God's covenant with Israel as a nation, the end.
Well, that of itself says that's the end of the Jewish economy.
Mm-hmm.
If it's no longer, they're no longer.
Carol?
In John, chapter 19, verse 30.
Yeah.
So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished."
He said, "It is finished." Then, now, what finished is he talking about?
His
task is finished.
Yeah.
Right? His task is, because what happens when he says that? Afterwards, he cries out and gives up the ghost and he dies. His job is finished. And so there's a lot, that's one of the things we've noticed in looking at these visions. There's a lot of times where it says the end is coming, or the end has come. It's not talking about the ultimate end, the end. It's talking about the end as far as they're concerned. You know, sitting there talking about Moab or something, it says, your end has come. You remember Ezekiel? All those times, he has a whole chapter where he just talks to Jerusalem, and he says, the end has come. The end has come. It has come. Your end has come. He says it over and over and over.
After Jesus resurrected, he said to his disciples that his resurrection, his all of this, his crucifixion, this
yeah.
was the end of the law of the prophets and the poets.
Yeah.
And they had been fulfilled.
As they had been fulfilled, exactly. And so when he says it is finished, he also means it is fulfilled. My job is done. I did what I came to do. Okay. Go your way, Daniel. They're sealed up. Verse 10. Many shall be purified and made white and refined. I wonder who he's talking about. The faithful of God. He talked. Remember, he talked about it in this period, the Greek period. He said that there are going to be people who know their God and who turn many to righteousness, but they're going to fall by fire and sword and everything to refine them and to make them white. He said the persecution of the righteous Jews in this time period is to purify them and make them white. Now, we're going to see the very same illustrations in Revelation, because John is, you know, Jesus, through the Holy Spirit to John, is preparing the church at the late first century for a period of 200 years of terrible persecution. And he says, you're going to be made white by this persecution. So he's not promising them a rose garden, he's promising them a cross and a resurrection. Okay. But the wicked shall do wickedly, verse 10, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. So what does this tell us? The wise are the ones who are going to be blessed, and the wise shall understand. Is there hope for us to understand what he's talking about here? Of course there is. If you seek wisdom, how do you seek wisdom? The Word of God. Read Solomon, read Proverbs, and he'll tell you how to do it. Read Psalm 19, 119.
There's been no point in writing if it can be
understood. Exactly. Now, the last little bit here. And from the time, and you think this would be over, but here he lays another one on us right here at the end. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But go your way till the end, for you shall rest and arise to your inheritance at the end of the days. Now the last one there just says, Daniel, look, I'm going to give you one little bit more information, but you're going to go ahead and rest. It means you're going to die, and you're going to rise to your reward for your inheritance at the proper time. But all of a sudden he brings up these two new numbers we haven't seen before. 1,290 days and 1,335 days. Hold it. What happened to 1,260? That was so nice. It was 3.5 years. It was 42 months. It was just, you know, everything lined up. And all of a sudden, 390? I mean, 1,290? So, very briefly, I told you about the intercalary months. The Jewish calendar was based on 30-day months, which meant every 3 years they had to add another month to the calendar to keep it from falling too far behind. That's called an intercalary month. That, by the way, ends up being 1,290 days. I could not find a reference as to which years in history were the years that they added those months, because I thought that would be an interesting thing if it happened to show up at 70 AD. But Jesus quotes this verse. When you see the abomination set up, the abomination that caused the desolation set up, know that the destruction of Jerusalem is nigh. He quotes this verse. So we know that's what it's talking about. It's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. But here he says 1,290. Okay, well, we know about 1,260 is a broken seven. So at least you can say, and Mac, the commentators are all over the place on this, by the way. The one I've been using, Jim McGuigan, who typically does a very good job, he says, I don't know. He just says clearly, he says, I don't know exactly why it's that. It could be because of the intercalary month, adding an extra month makes this. But 1,335, man, that makes no sense at all. It's another 45 days, a month and a half after 3.5 plus 30. You can play around with the numbers all day long, but symbolically we know what it means. Symbolically we know what it means. The broken seven, the three and a times and half a time, what is that always? A period of persecution and protection. A limited period where wickedness is going to overcome the righteous. A limited period, causing persecution, but God's going to protect you through it. And he says, even if it goes a little longer, blessed is he that comes to, who waits, and comes to the 1335. In other words, if you wait through this persecution, you're going to be blessed. If you make it through, you're going to be blessed. Come on in. Our class is running a little late. Come on in, have a seat. So, there's Daniel. And we will start next time. We will get into, there are a few visions we're going to cover in some of the minor prophets, and then we're going to hit the book of Zechariah. So if you want to read ahead, read Zechariah a few times. Thank you.